Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast, where we talk to grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. In today's podcast, we look back on the Tata Steel tournament in Wagenzee that ended last Sunday. As we all know, the Tata Steel Masters ended in a great victory for Nodirbek Abdusatorov from Uzbekistan, and the Challengers was won by 15-year-old Andy Woodward from Texas, USA. I'll look back on the Tata Steel tournament with Norwegian Grandmaster Jonathan Tistel, who visited the final days of the tournament and then decided to stay in the Netherlands to enjoy the beauty of Amsterdam. Jonathan Tistel was born in the US from a Japanese mother and Irish father. And then, long story short, he emigrated to London and next to Norway, where he has been living for many years. John is a grandmaster and a prolific journalist who worked for Reuters, wrote many stories for New in Chess, and wrote the acclaimed book Improve Your Chess Now. He's also been the captain of the Norwegian team, so he knows Magnus Carlsen really well. And he has been active in the chess world wearing a multitude of hats. Actually, if you want to know who's who in a chess press room, then the gentleman with the hat is usually Jonathan Tistel. John, welcome to the New in Chess podcast. How are you doing?
I'm great. Always good to be back here in the Netherlands and to get my annual dose of both the chess tradition of Wagenzee and then some culture in the rest of the country.
Yeah. So you witnessed the end of the tournament. I mean, we shared many thoughts about that when we were still in Wagenzee. We had a proud winner, Nodirbek Abdusatorov, who after several failed attempts when he was really very, very close, now finally won the tournament that he had been dreaming about since he was a kid. I mean, that's what he told us. He said, well, really, as a kid, he was already reading stories about Wagenzee, had no idea where that was, but it was clear that one day he hoped to be there and have his photo in the winner's gallery. He edged out his compatriot, Yavukir Sindarov, another great Uzbek talent. What's it with these Uzbeks these days, Jonathan?
I'm surprised you ask me for an answer, because I've been doing a lot of going around asking that of most of the people I meet here. I can't quite understand how they're doing it. Uh-huh. In fact, I'd be slightly nervous if I was India, even with my billion people and million grandmasters. And of course, when you're in Norway and you see chess become a national sport and a Christmas tradition for the entire country, you think still it's, even with all of that, it doesn't translate in the ability to produce world-class talents. Almost it will. I mean, my first reaction watching the end of the tournament and, of course, recent events is that Nodirbek has probably gotten a tremendous amount of inspiration by watching his younger competitor qualify for this candidate. And he's reacted brilliantly. And it was great to watch him finally overcome the sort of semi-curse of Tata Steel, because he's been nearly winner so many times that it's always been a good event for him. And for him to actually hold his nerve until the end. And even though he had his blip this time, he finished very, very strongly.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you have a lot of these things. I mean, I like to root for Arjun Aragayesi, to be quite honest, because I've known him such a long time and I love the way he's playing. And it's strange to see some of these guys develop their own personal traditions at these tournaments. And it'd be nice. It's nice to see some of them shaking it off.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the other thing is that a part of his reaction is that it's a sign of feeling the heat. Is he 21 now or is he still 20?
Sindarov.
Abdusatorov. I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
But I mean, he already feels the heat of the younger guys on his back.
Yes, yes.
And you watch this tournament, and I immediately start to think of things like I feel sorry for Gurel in Turkey, or somewhere has to watch, watch him being replaced by an even younger and more astonishing talent, perhaps. Probably, yeah.
Well, they almost played a tiebreak. I mean, if Abdusatorov hadn't won these two games in the final weekend, then there was a fair chance of that. And what I found funny was that they both, in fact, embraced the idea, but then at the same, obviously, Abdusatorov was very relieved that he didn't have to play it. But Sindarov, he was also very cool about it. He said, it would have been great and I would have loved to play it. But, I mean, he's been so unfortunate in several editions here. So it's great. And they are really friends and rivals.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing to see as well, because that seems to be the new normal as well, because the Indian players seem to be tremendously close. And they've had a really enviable team spirit for ages now, I think. So... But that does, I was slightly, the aggressive fighting levels of these young kids, there were two moments that I was slightly curious about, actually, looking back over the tournament. And one was Arjun's decision not to press against Gukesh quite early in the tournament, because he had a strong start and he felt like maybe he can break his personal curse. And he seemed to gradually run out of steam. And one of those... I thought might have been a critical decision was not to play against Gukesh, for whatever reason.
You felt that he didn't really want to try, or
no? I don't. I was just baffled by it, to be quite honest. And it's just that nothing to do with what it meant to him, but just from my own experience personally, and from watching these events enough over the ages, you start to get a feeling that if you get some momentum, you have to push, you have to ride it. You can't let it quiet down at all. And when he started by beating Prague really, really impressively, I was very surprised to see a guy with his default setting not just repeat the position suddenly. And he's had quite a good game against Gukesh. Yeah. He told me later that, in fact, he just mis-evaluated the position. And that's he thought he was doing the right thing, that's all. But Sindarov had a very strange decision down the stretch as well. He had a very short draw in the 12th round.
Yes.
And...
But quite an opponent and...
But he was white, and I just don't expect to see that from the kids at all.
It's funny that... Well, it's great news that it's become unusual. And... What I always also found remarkable was that, as you say, it's a very long tournament, and at some moment you have this momentum, and then you want to keep it. That two players who played very well in the event, Abdusatorov and also Jordan van Verreest, I was talking to them, and they more or less complained about the 3 days. They said, "Well, you're in this mood and things are going well, and then suddenly you grind to a standstill you want to continue."
I think I heard Hans complaining as well about
Hans
this.
Niemann.
Well, he only complained for a minute. He did say he needed the rest as well, I think, but
he forgot that his default setting was complain.
But Abdusatorov, yeah, I mean, he's just a wonderful example. And in fact, the fact that he hasn't won it before is probably due to that he really never stops. Like, he didn't have to go as hard down the stretch as he did.
That's right. Yeah. There were a couple of moments in earlier tournaments where he bungled his chances because he just went crazy and started attacking from move one, and it didn't work out. But what I found astounding was the way he looked back on the tournament, and when he compared it to the earlier tournaments, I mean, there was never any way that he looked for an excuse. He just said, "I was not mature enough. I made mistakes. I had to tell myself to do this better." And I thought, I mean, that really sounded like the words of a great champion.
His mentality has always impressed me. He seems he reacts extremely well to setbacks. He has tremendous self-belief. He's completely fearless. Completely fearless. He's never been intimidated by anybody. And it's terrific that even he, again, I had his blip here. I mean, he doesn't have to lose with White if he keeps maybe a more measured way of going at the tournament. But
His opponent played very well, right?
Yeah, sure.
That was a very good game by Anish Giri.
Yeah. And that's actually, that was one of the, okay, it wasn't a long-lasting shock, but I was absolutely astonished when I saw Anish being billed as the oldest player in the tournament. I mean, it's always been a very good mix of young and old, but that must be a record. Is this the youngest ever field?
Yeah, on average, this was easily the youngest ever. And then maybe it's only normal that we have a 21-year-old winner, Nodiberg Abdasatorov. But as you say, it was remarkable to see how focused he was. I mean, the first few rounds that I was there and I would see him, and we've met on earlier occasions, but he just excluded everything from his thought. He was fully focused, and he just walks past people as if he doesn't know them. And then once the job is done and he has won the tournament, then he's very friendly and accessible.
I was impressed by how lively outgoing he was actually after the games as well. Just even in the press room, he couldn't wait to start blasting through all of the variations he needed to check against the engine and this kind of thing. And he's very, very cheerful.
Yeah, that wasn't even
a winning day. It was just a quiet, I think that was a draw against the Orton. It was extremely, extremely interesting to watch him going at it.
He had an absolutely fantastic game against Fedoseev, which was incredibly complicated. And then afterwards, they were going through lines together. And every half minute, they would both collapse laughing. I mean, how much fun chess can be and how many surprises there can be in a game. So you mentioned Arjun Erigaisi. I mean, you like him a lot as a player. When it's easy to like him, when did that start?
Well, it's an interesting thing. This tournament was a sort of a reunion in a way. I was asked during the early years of the Magnus Incorporated versus Chesscom Global, before they became one, and before they merged later. But at the beginning, there was some real serious competition there. And Chesscom had this very nice event called their Pro Chess League, which just maybe changed the format very slightly each year. But traditionally, the captain of the Norwegian team had been Hammer, John Ludvig Hammer.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, I'm working a bit for Magnus now. I don't know if I should, you know, stick my head up above. Can you take over the reins here while the heat's on? So I said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And my first decision was that we needed to get in a couple of youngsters, because I thought at this kind of an event you need guys who are fast, preferably underrated also, because they had this, I believe they still had this rating, you know, average rating rule. So we were, I've always been in regular touch with Srinath Narayanan, who's the super trainer, one of the younger super trainers in India.
Yeah, and he was training.
He was training Arjun and maybe still Nihal was well at the time. I don't remember Arjun was not known at all.
Because
in fact, he said to me, he thought Arjun was actually probably the most dangerous of them all, but he wasn't getting much exposure or this or that. So I said, okay, sure. So we got Arjun on the team, and the young. A young speed demon who is well known for having a colorful online personality, because we needed a streamer. That was Hans Niemann. and then we added in our top Norwegian guys. And so, Arjun and Hans became like team mascots because they were delivering and they were kids. And so that was it. I mean, and Arjun became a loyal member of the Norwegian team, played every year. Until the event disbanded. So we've always had this little this relationship and been in touch. And Yeah, so he got a sort of some early exposure via Norway, and he's been a great kid. And then you watch what happened to him afterwards, and you just think,
So in that sense, it's pretty weird that over the past years he's been doing so poorly in Wagen Zee.
Yeah,
I mean he's had tremendous results. He's been what has he been, number three or four in the world. Mm. And here it just doesn't work, which make the final weekend extra interesting, because last year he had an absolutely lousy tournament, and in the final two rounds he beat Abdusatorov and Gukesh.
Yeah, last year was incredible.
Which
yeah.
had a huge influence on the outcome. And now, I mean, you never know. I think it was one of the things that... Abdusatorov could be nervous about to play against Arjun in the final weekend, but he kept his cool.
Yeah, I was hoping. Yeah, it looked like he might have finally solved it the way because he started so impressively in the first round, and he looked calm and controlled. But
did you speak to him about this? What this is about? I mean, he has lost so many points in Wagen Zee. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I did a bit. I mean, I didn't want to talk about it in too much detail because the tournament's still going on, and I'm afraid of, you know, maybe slightly, I don't know, I don't want to give him something extra to worry about or anything. But the thing that impressed me after our chat was how he seemed incredibly cheerful, even though he's still having this bad tournament. I mean, he didn't have any excuses. He seemed to be taking it in stride, and he wasn't worried about being able to shrug it off later.
Yeah.
And it was very encouraging, really. Mm. So the only thing that we discussed, like technically, I asked him about if he'd been consciously thinking about setting his risk levels about going into the tournament now or before. And he said he thought that there had been he said he thought that had been a problem for him in the past, that he had been able to tone down his natural aggression levels enough for a tournament of this of this level. But he thought he'd made proper adjustments this year, so he didn't offer me any excuses at all.
No.
And I was very pleased to see that he didn't seem to be taking it badly, because I know it was very painful for the first couple, but...
But the miraculous thing is that he wasn't the only one. I mean, all Indians were disappointing, and well, maybe Gukesh still he corrected some of his losses. But on the whole, they didn't deliver.
Yeah.
And many people they thought that their schedules had just been way too busy. It's probably one of those luxuries that you're getting invitations everywhere, you're welcome everywhere, and where are you going to say no? I mean, you've been a captain of a national team. I mean, this is something that your environment should do, don't you think?
It's funny. Well, my first reaction was to think perhaps it was the old-fashioned time pressure that was playing a role here, but I think that definitely had something to do with some of the results, but I don't think it can explain some of the extremely odd things we were saying.
Yeah.
How active are the guys? I think I've heard that offered as an explanation by a couple of the players as well, that they feel they are playing too much. But I have never heard any of them discuss about I should maybe play less. That's not an option.
It's a very difficult thing to do. Yeah. I think what is it, 20 years ago, someone like Topalov, I thought he was good at that. He wouldn't get an invitation, or they couldn't agree on the starting fee. And then, I won't play. But you will regret it. No, I won't regret it. I will take some rest. I will work on chess. Well, obviously, there's always with a tournament like that, I can say that some people, Arjun is not the first one who almost traditionally does badly here. Mm-hmm. There have been others. On the other hand, the third prize winner, Jordan van Verreest, he likes it there. He embraces the length of the tournament. And well, in 2021 he won it, and now he, yeah, actually, well, Abdusatorov, he was probably out of sight at some point, but in the final weekend he had two positions that he easily could have gotten something more from, and he might even have shared second place.
Mm-hmm.
How did you see his performance?
I love to watch him play. I think he's great when he's on form, and you can see that he's got quite a rare gift. Both he and the people he works with, but I would imagine especially him, since he's always involved, his incredible knack for finding original ideas in the opening, very original and quite often very deep.
Yeah.
Neither of which are easy to understand how it's possible in this day and age.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to have some sort of very close relationship with machines that I can't quite fathom, but it's terrific to watch, I think. And I guess, does it depend who beats, who wins the Geary Van Foreest game, which one is going to be challenging for a top honor? I don't know. But no, it's great to watch. I mean, of course, he should feel at home. I mean, he's working with, and also he's working with his brother here, I would believe, in the tournament. So you know you have a second who's going to be here, whereas most of the other guys, they can't convince anybody to stay away in the tournament for over 2 weeks now. So I think that must also have play a role.
Well, it is something that he has done on many occasions, that he doesn't necessarily go for the very strongest second that he could get, but that he's going for someone that he feels comfortable around, and which is clearly the case with his brother Lucas, who is a strong player. I mean, he's been Dutch champion, but in Jordan's position, you might think, okay, he goes for one of the truly recognized great trainers, but it's not something that he's necessarily looking for.
No, and I think I get the impression that there's a group of these young, really cagey, and I think at heart, you know, very sort of swashbuckling players. Like, I know that Jordan has he worked with Max on Marvin? I get the impression that he's a similar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, similar mold.
The year that he won, then Max was with him.
Yeah, and I know that a group of them were working with Johan Sebastian Christiansen, the Norwegian.
He's also been here with Jordan.
And he's a very similar type. He was really good at finding extremely inventive attacking ideas, or just entire attacking setups.
Yeah.
So yeah, that doesn't surprise me. It would make sense to you do it with the guys that you have that you get along well with and have a similar outlook.
Yeah. So he it was clear that he got very well with Johan Sebastian. But then in 2021, he was not available because he had something else to do, and he asked his good friend Max Warmerdam, who later also played in the Masters, and this year he was playing in the Challengers.
But the other thing is that this tournament has now gained the reputation for being the candidate's warm-up.
Yeah.
And that explains the old-fashioned time control, because it's fairly unique to the World Championship. And
maybe we should specify that. So thanks to Mr. Bobby Fischer, the great American chess player, we introduced the increment in time many years ago, to the big relief of all the time trouble addicts, or more the time trouble patients.
Yeah, and arbiters.
And arbiters. So now for this tournament, they returned to 40 moves in 2 hours, and no increment. So so many players, they got into terrible time trouble because they simply cannot divide their time properly, which is a weird thing for a professional, I would say.
Well, of course, they've never had to, I suppose, but you'd think they'd adapt somehow. But it's fascinating, of course, if you are a player from the past, to watch them grappling with this, and being terrified, actually, of it. And it's not just that I think that they can't, or they're not used to, allotting their time. I think it's the fact that they know they're not going to get any help this 30 seconds. They are more and more afraid the less time they have, I think. I think it becomes, they're more anxious about the whole situation. At least it looked like that.
So how did you deal with it? I mean, you've been playing many years without increments.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can remember when 40 and two hours was considered an extremely controversial speeding up of the game. But of course, you could see people adapting to that quite quickly.
Because it came from 2.5 hours.
Yes, yeah.
But Winix preferred...
We had... And then 16 in the next session for an hour. 16 in an hour, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Went up to 20. So, this was a slight shock. But of course, it has profound effects. But you had to get rid of the adjournments somehow. I mean, so it's not that. But there's also a tradition that... The players who are here getting used to the time control that they will be playing in the candidates match, it's quite often, isn't there a tradition that if they do badly here, that this is a good sign?
Yeah, it has happened. Like Karol Vana, he did very well, very badly here, and then he won the candidates. And I think that there have been other examples of the other way around results, which of course is... a consolation for everyone who played badly here. And the other state, they may think that they will be the exception. But how do you see this? So you have a very strong tournament like Wagensee, where it's in fact one of those big tournaments that you want to add to your list. I mean, you want to be just like Abdusatorov wanted to see his photo in the winner's gallery. He's not the only one. I mean, this is a big trophy that you can cherish, and it's hard to imagine that you give that up for anything related to the candidates. I mean, there's a couple of months in between. You have time, and you want to win this tournament. Well, let's say Anish Giri, he may say, "Well, I've already won this."
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if Anish would be more willing to save things for later, since he's actually won the tournament before. But how many others do we have? We have Sindorov, and this is his first, so of course he's not going to hold
Bluebaum,
back.
Who in fact was a very pleasant surprise.
Yes.
I mean, he qualified for the candidates, and I'm sure there will be many people who say, well, what is he doing there? Apart from the fact that he deserved it.
Yeah.
And... He played some great games in Wagensee.
He's backed it up. I suppose he was very slightly saddened by losing down the stretch because he won't be over 2700 on the next list or something.
But he briefly was, yes.
And then it's just a number. He's going to the candidates, so that would be very interesting indeed.
I think he was very happy that he had shown to himself that he could compete with these guys. Probably there were, let's say, in his best scenario, he might have had maybe a point more if things had gone well. But on the whole,
he did play some very nice games.
Yes.
He played some very nice games.
He won a beautiful game against Gukesh, the world champion. I mean, Gukesh is the one we keep focusing on. He's under a magnifying glass, and we expect only the best from him. And whatever he does that contradicts that, people are critical of him, even if he himself has always been modest.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. At DGT, we want to bring people together and help them grow through play by supporting chess and creating innovative, high-quality products for players everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
How good is he, John?
Okay, that's a tricky one. It's really hard to tell, I think, still. And I don't think that's strange. He's ridiculously young.
Yeah, we forget that because he looks so mature.
Yeah, but I mean, he's absurdly young. I mean, it's only natural that he should be uneven and changing and developing. Mm. I know that, I mean, Magnus has said a lot of very, I wouldn't say they're insulting, but I mean, I would imagine he is indeed genuinely baffled by the way Gukesh plays because it's so foreign to the way Magnus thinks.
Yeah.
But he's still at his best, he's absolutely incredible. Mm. One of the most interesting things I think about the candidates is that I would imagine that Caruana must be really a strong favorite, I would have thought, given his experience. And in recent years, I know this isn't backed up statistically, but when I'm watching him playing, I get the impression he's playing better and better, but he's not quite putting all of the games away. But he could very easily show his top form sometime soon when he needs it. The problem is, I think he must have the worst score in the world against Gukesh of the top players, though, which would make an eventual Caruana Gukesh match really fascinating.
Yeah,
because I mean, I can't remember him scoring against Gukesh nearly, but I'm sure he has. But he's really, Gukesh is his nightmare opponent. So I don't know. Personally,
maybe he's looking forward to correct that. Let's not forget.
Sure he would. If he got there, I'm sure that it wouldn't mean so much. But it is an interesting thing.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, when Bobby Fischer played to Boris Paskey in Reykjavik, he had never beaten him.
And, that's true. Of course, that's the perfect example. But it's going to be really fascinating. Really fascinating. I don't know what I haven't heard Gukesh talking about his title defense, but I would imagine he's very balanced about it all, not terribly worried.
I'm sure there's a big team working on that, getting everything ready at the right moment. Mm-mm. I mean, he's been very professional in that. He's been working with Gajewski, who is a very, very experienced trainer for several years, and they believe in each other. Mm-hmm. And then there were these, he had this South American mental coach, and I'm not sure if he's still in touch with him, but he played an enormous role in the candidates in Toronto.
What, like a sporting psychologist?
Yes, they had many sessions before the candidates tournament in Toronto, and then I think towards the end, I mean, he could reach out to him whenever he wanted to, and the mental coach, he left the initiative to Gukesh.
Is this a guy known at all in chess circles, or he's just sporting in general?
Do you know? Sporting in general. Mm-hmm. I think he worked with cricket teams and other sports, and he turned up for the final round in Toronto. Suddenly there was this new face, and that was the guy who he was always, well, he didn't claim any real contribution to his success there. He said, let's say mental balance and what I can do. It's just 1%, but 1% can be something.
I'm a huge believer. I mean, for ages, I mean, before the Indian boom, I've always been a great believer that most players would benefit hugely from learning how to meditate, various meditation techniques and practices. Mm. I've always thought that was I know it helped me personally. I know plenty of things that I tried to try and get through the psychological barriers. And you, of course, you had to do everything yourself in the old days. But so I think it's just wonderful when I see like almost every Indian top player now meditating at the beginning of the game. And I think that's fantastic. And I'm sure that's just another ingredient in their general approach.
It's one of the things that Eric Icy has said, that when he made that final step, and that was partly could be explained by the new type of yoga that he was doing.
That was the thing, his equanimity when I spoke to him here, that really impressed me. So it wouldn't surprise me if that he's been working a bit on that that side of it.
Yeah.
And well, I think it's just generally a very wise approach to work with somebody on your sporting psychology. But if it seems like there's only something very small separating him from breaking all the barriers, because you just see him coming, well, second or third when, in these really key events. And if there's nothing huge at stake, he seems to win with no effort whatsoever nearly. And he's getting a much more rounded player as well. He doesn't always just hack them.
Yeah, but it's tempting to connect this to the early parts of your journalistic career, John. I mean, you well, one of the highlights in your career were the Kasparov Karpov matches.
Yeah,
where there was that there were no yogis or yoga trainers, or, but there were mental specialists who did entirely different things.
I started at the end of the parapsychologist age.
To what extent did you feel that they really had an effect in those matches? Because they played an important role.
Yeah, in Baguio, of course, they had a huge role, but that was before my time. But I was in Murano. And
it's 81.
In 81, the Korchnoi Karpov rematch. Unfortunately, not much of a match, but it was still in full flow there. There was definitely a parapsychologist with the Karpov team. I don't remember. It's a long time ago. I don't remember if it was Zukar, the famous Zukar, but whoever it was, it didn't even have to be a parapsychologist, I suppose, as long as you let the Korchnoi delegation know that this guy who's sitting in this row, he's our parapsychologist.
Yeah.
But, for sure. I know that Victor was moving his hotel room around so that he wouldn't get, mental beamed or whatever it was during the entirety of the event. He wanted to keep moving around. And I was working for Reuters during the event, and they'd hired on Lev Albert to be an assistant, sort of technical assistant, grandmaster, the assistant.
Well, and he had left the Soviet Union, and he was very firmly opposed to anything Soviet, so he was a good help for...
Yeah, but he has a lot of background about the funny business that used to go on there, and he was... I think he was willing to believe that any kind of strange business would not only be employed, but might be effective, and he told me stories about... he told me stories about they would be playing in tournaments. There would occasionally be test tournaments held. I suppose the games were never shown. And he said every player was given a different substance to utilize under this event.
Oh, really?
He had all sorts of stories like this. So he was fairly convinced that Victor could be bothered by all sorts of things, and they should be very careful. He didn't think any of it was... dismissed.
I always wondered, to what extent these methods were effective, or to what extent they were the threat was bigger than the execution. Because a later interview I had with Viktor Korchnoi, then he spoke about Murano, and he said, on the eve of the match, there suddenly arrived a big truck. It was a big truck that the Soviets had brought with them, and it was full of equipment. I don't know what was in it, but it was full of equipment. And after the match, for weeks, I had conjunctivitis in his eye. And I'm absolutely certain that it must have been some radiation from that truck. And I was listening to that, and I thought, he believes this for sure. So maybe I should take this seriously. But there was this whole atmosphere of people driving each other crazy.
And of course, he played the game too, of course. They started at low level, just the hijinks between him and Spassky and... different versions of varieties of sunglasses and...
It was that cycle, the semifinal, was it?
That was before Murano,
Budapest or
not before Murano? Bucharest, Baguio, wasn't it? It must have been the cycle before Baguio.
This match where they barely were sitting at the
table. Yeah, they were kicking each other in different reflective sunglasses, and then counter sunglasses, and I don't remember. They got up to all sorts of really silly business. They would start playing from the, not at the board.
Yeah,
they would think in the audience or in the back or something. Yeah, they wouldn't sit at each other across from the board.
It's very funny, John, that last year I got a letter which Paskey sent to Lubos Kovalik. And Lubos Kovalik, he was working for a publishing house in the United States. And Boris Paskey, he wanted to write a book that was based on that match against Korchnoi.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was sitting in this wrestling room behind the stage and thinking about his moves there. And he wanted to write a book explaining that, why that was permissible or not permissible. The premise of that book was, to my mind, was pretty idiotic.
Uh-huh.
But it you could see that he was so obsessed with it.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating to me, because it's just Murano. I keep saying Murano. Is that the one I mean? No, Baggio.
Baggio.
I did mean Murano. I was with Murano, but Baggio was just so crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we've never had that. I mean, besides all of the...
That was the first real match that... Well, for the World Championship. I mean, they had played another match before, but this was the first World Championship match, 78.
Yes,
and 78. At some point it was 5-5. And Korchnoi had fought his way back.
Yeah.
And then he took way too much risk in the last game, and suddenly the match was over. But there was a general feeling that Korchnoi had his chance in that match, right?
Yeah, for sure. Because, well, for one thing, they managed to get to 5-5 in a reasonable number of games.
Mm-hmm.
So the six win rule didn't look crazy yet.
Yeah.
But it was, of course, a record long match at the time. But it was just the number of, I mean, okay, you had this, the Korchnoi and Spassky started the silly business with the glasses and then not sitting each across the room, the table from each other because of, I don't know whether they actually thought it was dangerous to be there or they were just trying to psych each other. I don't remember the details. But in Baggio, you had Zukar, who was the parapsychologist, clearly.
Working for Karpov.
Working for Karpov, sitting fairly close to the front row, if not in the front row, and just staring at him all the time. That was his job, to stare at Korchnoi. And of course, I'm sure it was hugely effective.
Mm.
And he countered with the Ananda Marga Korchnoi, which were, I'm not even positive about, were they Buddhists or quasi-Buddhists?
But they had been convicted of something.
And it turned out that they had some sort of criminal charges hanging over them or something. But then you have all of these brightly colored, brightly robed people counter yogaing and meditating him.
And suddenly Korchnoi standing on his
head. Yes, Korchnoi getting training. And then there was the yogurt controversy as well, because they were complaining that his... The flavors of Anatoly's yogurt could be coded messages.
Yeah.
I mean, anything and everything that they could fight about and distract each other was used in that. So, I mean, Murano was fairly calm by comparison, but it was still going on in the background, definitely influencing how at least the Korchnoi camp thought about everything.
So what would happen if somebody stands in the audience in Wagensee and just keeps staring at one of the players? Can you get him removed?
Do people think it like this anymore?
Well, probably not.
I mean, nowadays, I would imagine you could quickly get at least as worked up now, surely, because now we have Havana syndrome and who knows what else people can do with a gadget and a guy. Yeah, I don't know.
Mm.
I don't think it would take long to start up this kind of thing again.
Oh, really?
It did. Yeah, why not?
Mm.
Mm. Although I think it would be more technology this time. Yeah.
Is there a serious threat there? Or you're just trying to scare me?
Yeah, I don't think we've got anybody with chips implanted quite yet. But
let's not go there.
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way, on-the-spot reports of the biggest events, top-notch instruction, independent journalism, chess history that comes to life, and great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition, or the digital edition for phone, tablet, or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
So, well, at the start, we talked about Uzbekistan and how the country is growing as a chess nation. There are other players as well. They have Sindarov in the candidates tournament now. They will have the Olympiad at the end of the year. And it doesn't come from nothing. I mean, already in 92 in Manila, the Uzbek team won silver, which most people have forgotten.
I was there and I don't remember that.
Yeah. Well, it probably people have forgotten because most of the players there, they were not real Uzbeks. They were Soviets. Okay. So I think there was Grigory Serpa, who doesn't look very Uzbek. Mm-hmm. There was, I think there was this player, Nenashev, who later changed his name into something German. But okay, in fact, that was not the real start of the Uzbek magic. But of course, Rustam Kazimjanov, he became, we have to say, FIDE world champion, because there were two world champions then. Mm. And that was celebrated big in his country. And I think that it is also one of the things that Abdusatorov mentions, that he says, well, as a kid, that was one of my examples. We had someone from our country who won that title. But you're saying that even despite that example, that it's still amazing how big it is?
Yeah, I think so, because it's not a natural leap to get a local hero and then be able to produce a new generation of heroes, I think. Mm. Just thinking immediately about Norway, of course, mm-hmm. where Magnus has completely transformed the country in terms of chess. I mean, yeah. Chess is a national passion. Mm-hmm. Watching the world rapid and blitz has become...
It's good that you mentioned that again, because it is something that people should realize, that so many Norwegians, whether they like chess or not, they are in front of their television, yes, watching the world rapid and blitz.
The world rapid and blitz has become...
Over Christmas.
Yes, it's a national Christmas tradition now.
Yeah.
Forever, I don't know how many years it's been going. Maybe it must be close to 10, mm-hmm. or around 10. Yeah. But it is now absolutely essential as any of the traditional Christmas movies or music or any of this. Everybody sits down, they watch every single round of the live.
Mm-hmm.
They send in pictures of themselves and their pets at the board, and it's just the whole thing. I mean, it's absolutely crazy, completely Christmassy and Magnus related.
Yeah.
Every single year.
And once again, you don't need to be a real chess player to do that.
No, of course not.
No.
Because the coverage since the beginning, which would have been around the Carlsen and Nod matches, they have been extremely innovative, extremely clever in making the chess accessible to everybody. And a lot of these things that you see now that you take for granted is some of the most more, you know, quirky maybe ways of watching an event. Things like heart monitors, confession booths, all of these things were introduced and trialed in the Norwegian TV events.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite thing is, and chess readers may have heard this many times from me, mm-hmm. but one of the ways you get this across to people outside of Norway is you turn on the live chess. This is already a big surprise. You see you know, a normal like sports like transmission. They're covering a chess event live. It's not taped or anything. And there's a little ticker, across, the little news ticker across the front of this, at the bottom of the screen is about showing the football scores.
Really?
Yeah. And is maybe the strongest image for your average sports person to understand what's happened with chess in Norway. But we haven't produced regular candidates at all. And we've had a world junior champion. We've had a guy go over 2,700. But we haven't had that kind of follow-up. So my guess would be that we lack some kind of general infrastructure because our federation doesn't have many funds. Mm. We couldn't send a team to the European Championships this year, which was mildly scandalous, but not hugely unexpected either.
Mm. That was purely a financial matter.
That was purely a financial matter. So we have huge visibility and huge levels of interest, and we have lots of people playing, I suppose, relatively, I would say, huge numbers of amateur players, I would imagine. People are playing in pubs, you know, during the first Carlsen and non-match chess sets actually sold out in the country, this kind of thing. And people are playing on their phones, of course, a lot. We have there's a latent population, at an amateur level, there's been a huge boom. But in terms of producing regular talents, I would say, I mean, with all due respect to the guys, the guys that we've produced, but we haven't produced candidates, and certainly not candidates in plural.
But are you too impatient, or do you think?
I don't know. How long has it taken Uzbekistan? The Anand effect took quite a long time, I suppose. And I think, I would say that in terms of India, you also needed Sagar Shah. Mm-hmm. You needed somebody who was promoting books and equipment and coverage and then somehow managing to rope in celebrities and, and you know, producing more than 24 hours of content a day, even though there's just...
taken care of in Norway, you mean? I mean, the celebrities are there, they...
Yes, this is true too, yeah. But I guess, they have this massive potential base of people. But I would imagine, again, it must be an infrastructure thing because they've also had government support follow and huge sponsorship interest.
Yeah.
And we have some government interest, but in terms of sponsorship or some sort of ambitious program for creating future generations of Superman, we don't have this yet. Whereas now I would imagine India is going to be producing them regularly now for a good while. They've got so many now, and they have a real industry now of trainers and pathways to professionalism.
Yeah, but maybe, okay. You're living there and you know all these people. At the same time, I feel that you're a bit too pessimistic or too... because if I'm looking at the world rankings, I mean, how many grandmasters Norway has produced? It goes down to... Well, there's something like 12, 14 grandmasters?
More than that, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's more. Okay, there's more than that.
But they're not. It depends on your metric. I'm thinking it would be very nice to be producing world class players regularly.
Okay, but then let's say with Uzbekistan, when was the world championship in Libya that he won? Is it 2000? What is that, 6 or something? Or they and.
Oh, so you're okay. So you're saying the spark in Uzbekistan is actually before Norway's. I suppose so.
Yeah. Well,
how many people live in Uzbekistan?
It was 2004 that was that championship.
Okay, so it had nearly a 10-year head start, 10-ish year head start. If you look at it as purely the inspiration of a champion.
Yeah.
How many people in Uzbekistan?
That's a good question. I knew yesterday now, but I'll be quick. So let me see. Uzbekistan, where are you? Population 38 million.
Okay, so that's it's a much bigger country.
Yeah, so how many people have you got?
I would guess 5.5 maybe now.
Okay.
Five-ish.
I think it's pretty impressive what you're doing.
I think we do need some sort of greater level of support for the Federation, mm-hmm. somehow.
Yeah.
Either state or commercial. That would be, with that, I think we suffer from the age-old complaint of you produce somebody who has a chance and he has to make a decision about what he's going to do professionally. Yeah?
Okay.
And chess is not a career path, really, still. I mean, you can. It depends, of course. But given the cost of living in Norway and
too wealthy, John. That's a good thing about Uzbekistan, that they automatically choose a chess career.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a huge advantage. I don't know to what extent it was the same in, I would imagine it took a long time before it was obviously a good career path in India, but I'm not sure.
I think that the wish to break out from some social background and be successful in a sport is obviously much bigger than in Norway.
Mm.
You have it too good.
You can choose a different metric. Yeah, I mean, Norway is obviously, I mean, just the things I mentioned, it's just amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if I was going to tell young me to pick a country and then suddenly when times got tough, chess would become interesting enough to bail me out professionally.
Yeah.
And I chose Norway consciously. No, that wouldn't have happened. I mean, it's an absolute miracle. Absolute miracle.
No, because I still, whenever I'm in Norway, I'm surprised by the enthusiasm and the big groups of young players who are there with their trainers who were the big promises from the previous generation. So I understand what you're saying, especially when a federation isn't able to send a team to an important team event. But on the whole, I think
we have Simon Agnestein plugging away at his academy. I mean, he's the reason we pump out GMs. Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is that.
Well, and you have chess on national TV. I mean, not only around Christmas, also Norway chess is broadcast live in a very accessible manner. So there's a lot of good things.
Sure. Yeah. I wouldn't.
Maybe the only thing that is lacking in Norway now is your new book that you're working on. I mean, let's switch the subject in a very subtle manner. I mean, you've written a book years ago that was successful and has seen reprints, and now you're working on a prequel. And that's what I understand.
That's how I've always described it.
Yes.
You could just as well call it a sequel, because it's taken so long to write that we've had to adjust to many of the evolutionary changes of...
Yeah. Yeah, so your first book was called Improve Your Chess Now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good title, because that's what you have to do when you want to improve. You should do it now. And what was the typical strength of that book? What was it about?
In mind, I was hoping to present a number of things that I thought were very important about studying and training chess, and the end goal I thought would be that you would learn to train yourself. But I didn't actually say this, which was a mistake, I think.
Uh-huh.
But the skills investigated, I think, were approached in a fairly unusual way, a fairly original way, and it got a lot of attraction is not the right word. I mean, it's a very, very well-respected book, and it's introduced some terminology, but basically it focused, the two most important factors covered were visualization and calculation. And it was inspired by a thing the late, great ex-Russian Grandmaster Anatoly Lane said to me once. We used to analyze together quite a bit in the good old days when I was active. And he had this knack of just saying very striking but odd things to you that would strike you as revelations later when you couldn't stop thinking about them. One of the things he just said to me offhand one day was, "I don't think like a tree. Do you think like a tree?" And this was the starting point for the book. And he was talking about...
Do you think like a tree?
Yeah, do you think like a tree? Mm. And he was talking about, with some disdain, obviously, the very famous book, Think Like a Grandmaster, by Kotov, Alexander Kotov. And where Kotov introduced his phenomenally popular idea of the tree of variations and how he thought people should think and organize their thoughts.
And how they all branch out.
Yeah, branching and how you should work up your way up another branch. He basically was saying, nobody thinks like a tree. So I thought about this. I couldn't stop thinking about it. And you read exactly what Kotov writes and you think, yeah, this is completely artificial. Nobody thinks like this.
And I
mean, Kotov he should have said this, made it very clear that this is sort of an idealized like study technique. It's not something you should be doing actually when you're playing at all. Yeah. I think. But anyway, besides the actual visualization and talking about blindfold, which is also slightly controversial because a lot of people say blindfold but chess makes you crazy and this and that, my basic argument, it's not even an argument as far as I'm concerned, is that I don't know what percentage of the game is played in your head, but I would imagine it's 99% of the game you play is actually taking place in your head. Yeah, the variations are all the... It's all moving around in there. Nothing's much is happening on the board in terms of what you need to look at. And you also see very classically famous people like Svidler and Shirov, if they're counting, or Ivanchuk's another good example. These guys, when they're making an extremely difficult, complex calculation, they'll look up at the ceiling or they'll look up. Yeah, I mean, the board's a distraction. It's all taking place there. So that was one thing. And that was almost never written about. And then there was the, do you think like a tree and why you shouldn't like think like a tree? And this was considered heresy, of course, because Kotov was... And I got a lot of really positive feedback from Russians who read it, saying, thank God, finally somebody had the nerve to say this.
Yeah, somebody finally cut a tree.
it was wonderfully well received. I mean, in Dvoretsky, for example, it was the only book he recommended when asked about if he was just going to recommend a book about calculation, if he had any thoughts, and that was the one he chose. So it's got a tremendous reputation over the year. And of course, that's had a very big role in making me extremely fearful about writing a second book. But the second book is a sequel, and it's basically many of the same topics revisited, but in greater and wider detail with a student voice, who's my friend, the stand-up comedian Nick Doody, who's actually a stronger player than I was expecting. Because I originally thought this will be aiming it for a much lower writer, broader audience, but Nick has quickly proved to be strong enough that we had to, that it was again getting slightly above the level that you would expect from something that's called Improve Your Chess Now, which has always bugged me, I have to say, because it sounds easy. And the book wasn't easy.
No, but it's great to have him involved because I know that you've been going to the festival in Edinburgh for many years, and you've been working together with Nick Doody. Mentioned well, don't forget that name. Nick Doody is a stand-up comedian and a good friend of John's, and they are in the process of writing a book together, which hopefully will come out somewhere in the course of this year. So that would be great.
You've met Nick.
Yes, I met him in London.
Have you seen him perform as well?
No, not yet. It's one of my... I think I missed one where I was too late in London, but I'd love to go to Edinburgh one day and see him. And I look forward to the book, John. Our time is up, I think. I mean, the hour that we aim at. Is there anything that you think we definitely should have talked about that we didn't? It was great to have your take on Wagon's A and also to go back to the Kaspar of Karpov adventures. Oh, yeah. But okay, we should elaborate on that on another occasion, because that's not something you do in 1 minute.
No, but that's, yeah, there are plenty of stories from that one, sure.
Yeah. Then we let this one rest, and one day in a not so far future, we will talk some more about Kaspar of Karpov, because it's incredible to think how much impact those matches had. And
I'm constantly reminded by how long ago it is. I'm going to just remember at the end of the European Team Championship, or maybe the World Team Championship, on the bus way on the way back, on the way to the airport, on the way home, I was sitting next to Piorun, I think it was, the Polish grandmaster and world solving champion or something. And we got to be chatting, and I mentioned that I'd covered the match, and he was so happy. He'd never met anybody who from that age. Wow, somebody old enough to have witnessed that with their own eyes. I got a lot of that, because it was a tremendous series of events, the Karpov Kasparov clashes, and of course there are many, many stories. And it's funny now to feel like a guardian of that bit of history, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a great bit of chess history. And it happened many years after Fischer-Spassky, which also still is a great story. So there's been many of those stories that will never disappear, I think. Mm-hmm. But for the moment, we're going to look forward to the publication of your book.
Yes,
and think a bit more about Tata Steel, where so many nice games and remarkable games were being played that definitely deserve a second look. So thank you, Jonathan, and good luck with everything you're doing.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If this podcast has gotten you in the mood to read a fine chess book or to subscribe to the wonderful New in Chess magazine, then please have a look at our shop on our website, newinchess.com, where you can treat yourself to a great chess read. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.